Welcome to The Middle Ground, an audio series highlighting literature and exploring literary communities across Central and Eastern Europe.
In this episode, host Joe Williams speaks with Slovene poet, author, and academic Katja Perat about her novel, The Masochist, and some of the cultural issues it invokes. Joe began by asking her, how is it she's come to live in St. Louis in the United States?
Well, the Department for Comparative Literature at Washington University was trying to start, or in many ways restart, Track for International Writers, that's in a very, very different shape and form, existed at the university when William H. Gass was teaching here. And they were some of the professors that whose idea that was were kind of wandering around the globe at various literary festivals, harvesting talent. So I kind of got drafted for it. And after some time of thinking whether or not I'm ready to relocate to a different continent and this very strange particular middle of a different continent, I decided that I can always give it a try and give up if it'll feel too strange for me. And, well, 5 years later, I'm still here.
So do you feel quite settled and at home then in the United States?
I have a sense that once you became a person who has, I mean, there's an expression coming from a book of its title called You Can Never Go Home Again. And I guess what I wanted to say that once you became a person who has left a home to resettle, I think home becomes a very convoluted notion. So I could never claim that I feel at home in the U.S. or in the Midwest, but both the U.S. and the Midwest, and St. Louis in particular, have become a huge part of my life and a huge part of, you know, my sentimental education, as I conceive sentimental education an ongoing process that never ends. So it's more like, it's become a part of my world and I've become a part of its world. But I think that all of those things are significantly different or feel significantly different than they did when I was still a person who was very tied up with my birthplace, Ljubljana, and like belonged to it fully and didn't quite have an experience of, you know, not being a person who just stays in the province that gave birth to them. I think those two are very different lives and very different experiences of being in a place. And I feel kind of grateful that I have relocated as late in life as I did, because now it feels that I got to be both of these people in one lifetime.
So your lived experiences then since moving to the United States have modified and updated your relationship with Slovenia and the place and the region that you were born and grew up in. Is that the case?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, in a sense that there's certain things about how places are that you can only see if you look at them from above, in a sense. I don't know. I just think that maybe there's like a different way of seeing the structure of the world or the interconnectedness of the world once you've gained more comparative material. I'm not saying that like either is better or worse, but it's definitely different. And I think that, yeah, my both my imagination and my way of understanding things has become significantly more globalized than it was before I moved.
Later on, we're going to hear some excerpts from your latest book, The Masochist, which is a novel, and we can discuss that in more depth shortly. But before that, I wanted to take a step back and talk a little bit more about your earlier work. And the majority of that has been poetry. Is that correct?
Yeah, I've published two collections of poetry prior to this novel.
So how has your kind of artistic output evolved? What's led you from writing poetry to now gravitating towards novel writing?
Yeah, I have a feeling that whenever I try to describe that process, I always describe it as if I have no personal agency to it, which I don't know if it's entirely true, but it's often what it feels like. I felt that I was writing poetry because that was the natural expression of my thought at the time, that I think was very tightly interwoven with the fact that I come from philosophy. My BA is in philosophy, and philosophy has always been and still is a very important mode of how I think, with, I guess, a particular connection to the word as the medium for meaning. And I think that the poetry in that sense was some sort of, I don't know, like bore the closest semblance to how my way of engaging like thought in language came from philosophy. But then after a while, I figured that in spite of the fact that this is still how I feel about both thinking and writing, I also want to find a medium that would make it possible or more possible to tell stories, because there's something about how life is narratively constructed that became very central to what I was interested in about people and about societies and about history. And I felt that this is, you know, just something that kind of demanded to be concentrated in a novel form. So I don't know. I just felt that it's some sort of, that it just like points to a type of a change in what I'm curious about and what kind of form will allow space for that curiosity to come through.
So on that note then, maybe we could hear something from your latest book, The Masochist, on Easteros Books, which came out this year. I believe you prepared a reading, a bilingual reading, something in original Slovene, followed by the corresponding English.
Yeah, I will read an excerpt from a chapter, first in Slovene, and then in the English translation by Michael Dignan. Nikoli nisem videla lembrške pisarne starega policijskega načelnika, a ko sem videla Freudovo, je skoraj bolečo jasnostjo vzniknila v mojem duhu kot prikazem primerjave. Leopold je svojega očeta omenjal redko in kadar je govoril o njem, je govoril z nekakšno posiljeno spoštljivostjo. Samo enkrat si je bolan privoščil zdrs v resnico. Imel je pljučnico, sedela sem ob njegovi posteli in mu čelo močila z obkladki. Je možno, je rekel nenadoma brez napovedi, da sem bil na dan, ko je umrl moj oče, srečen? Sem bil srečen zato, ker je umrl? Vročično se je zazrl vame, njegov pogled je bil moten, a me je vseeno izostril z odločnostjo, ki je morala vzeti veliko energije. Njegova potla dlan me je zgrabila za zapestje. Boš tudi ti srečna, ko bom umrl? Bilo mi je 7 let in nisem ga razumela. Njegove bolezni, njegove krivde, njegove projekcije. Bilo me je strah. Odkimala sem s preveliko vnemo in si pri tem skoraj zlomila vrat. A Leopold se je zdel potolažen. Zatisnil je oči in zaspal. I had never seen it, the office of the old chief of police in Lemberg, but when I saw Freud's, it leaped in my mind with an almost painful clarity as a ghost of an analogy. Leopold rarely ever mentioned his father, and when he did speak about him, it was with a sort of forced reverence. Only once, when he was sick, did he permit himself a slip of truth. It was when he had pneumonia, and I was sitting at his bedside, changing the wet compresses on his forehead. Is it possible, he suddenly said with no warning, that on the day my father died, I was happy? Was I happy because he was dead? He looked at me feverishly, and although it was as if there was a film over his eyes, they singled me out so emphatically that it took a lot of energy for me. His sweaty hand grabbed me by the wrist. "Are you also going to be happy when I die?" I was 7 years old and didn't understand. Him, his illness, his guilt, his projection. I was frightened. I shook my head so energetically, nearly breaking my neck, but Leopold appeared to be comforted. He closed his eyes and dropped off to sleep. After that, he spoke even more seldom about his father. I'm almost certain that he never described him. Neither his manner of dress, nor his build and face, nor his behaviors, beliefs, and principles. Everything I knew about him, about that person who died before I even had a chance to know him, I had to intuit from Leopold's personality and description of his father's office. Perhaps that's why my image of him was so deeply imprinted on my mind. His herb garden, the butterflies affixed with pins to their spots in glass-covered cases, the marionettes depicting a Carpathian robber standing obediently in the corner, subdued for all time. He must have loved order, old Zachar Mazoch. He must have been domineeringly rational, that botanist, collector of crystals, tusks, and bones. Even in his godlessness, he must have been unwaveringly convinced that the man was destined to rule the earth by breaking it into smaller categories to be sorted and named. The selection of portrait busts arranged on the desk in front of him attested to his models. Frederick the Great, Napoleon, Socrates, Goethe. Bearskins were arrayed along the walls in durable evidence of his hunting exploits. He was the lord of the law, the hand of reason, set down in that uneasy province beset by outright beastly passions in order to rule it. Old Zachar Mazoch must have been everything that Leopold was not, reliable, pedantic, inconspicuous, domineering, unrelenting, and cruel, but above all, he had to be exalted. A man whom the fact that nobody contradicted him solidified in the conviction that doubt was something that only afflicted others. Even Freud, if you should judge him by the state of his office, was different in every respect from old Zachar Mazoch. But because he wasn't his son, he could be different without defying him. He was a collector too, but what he collected was already named. Freud's collection consisted of things that stood in for what surpassed human beings, not what humans were able to dominate. His office desk was cluttered with figurines of wise men, gods, and beasts that were never meant to be merely beasts. Pallas Athena, Chinese sage, Isis with oars in her lap, one of Toto's baboons, statuettes vainly announcing what kind of company Freud would have chosen if he could choose. They represented the community that he wanted to be a member of, and in this respect, they expressed his arrogance as well as his doubt. They were turned to face him, not the patient. If old Zachar Mazoch's collection signified that he wanted followers, Freud testified to a need for companions. Was he lonely?
Thank you, Katya. We just heard Katya Perat reading from her latest release, The Masochist, out now on East Los Books. So, Katya, I think our readers will have identified and recognized some of the characters that make up this book. It's quite an intriguing concept, the form that you've chosen for the book. Could you explain a little bit about the book and its formal characteristics, please?
Oh my God, that's not the easiest question I've ever received concerning this novel. Well, I guess it's like a... So, I guess the main thing to be said about this book, that it's some sort of an exercise on autobiography. It's clearly not my autobiography. It's a pseudo-historical autobiography of an invented literary character called Nadezhda Mozart, née Zachar Mazoch, who is placed amongst actual, real, factually existing historical characters of Fantasy Ekla Austro-Hungarian Empire. She is the presumed daughter of Leopold von Zachar Mazoch, whom the history has only remembered because Kraft Ebing, in his Psychopathia Sexualis, coined the term masochism on the basis of his last name. Once in his time, Leopold von Sacher-Masoch was a very, very famous Austro-Hungarian novelist who is, I guess, most famous for his novel Venus and Furs, that also became the basis of the Masochist fantasy. And Matthias Moser is presumably a child he had adopted and taken care of, who then grew up to be a part of the Viennese high cultural circles and one of the early patients of psychoanalysis. So in that, this is also largely a novel that is trying to interrogate psychoanalysis as a, not necessarily a source, but definitely an integral part of subject building for certain women of a certain era and of certain social circles trying to figure out how their lives that have until recently have been rendered meaningless might bear meaning for them, but also for history.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like a very ambitious, high concept, quite intellectually dense and engaged novel, which is very admirable for your first novel. Well done. But it's probably also quite consistent in keeping with your earlier poetic output. Would you say that's true, that you do seek to create and write literature that is quite intellectually dense and engaged?
I mean, I guess there's two ways how to answer this question. First is, of course, I'm a literary scholar, and I'm an intellectual laborer by my profession. And I think that, like, particularly this novel as a work of fiction, in a lot of ways does, like, spring from the same source as my academic work, in a sense that there's a lot of questions, but more particularly modes of thinking about certain, I guess, historicizing or philosophizing questions that academic labor can't really reach because of its formal limitations, and that I thought can only be, like, answered in the form of a novel because of its particular attention. I mean, not that every novel has to pay that particular attention, but the novel as a form definitely leaves room to pay particular attention to people's, you know, feelings and modes of being in the world that you, and unless you're an anthropologist, can't really interrogate in academic pursuits. And I felt that these are questions that are simultaneously, that are intellectual questions, but they're also personal questions. So I felt that, like, the novel made it possible for me to just play around with the intersection of these two worlds that are often somehow almost forcibly separated. But when we try to think about, you know, historical periods or people that have become important intellectual figures, we still do experience them as people. And the, you know, world of history is always peopled in one way or another. But as to the connections or the threads that, like, this novel has to my poetry, I think what's, I guess, most important that, I mean, having come from poetry, that I think in a sense can be more formalist than novels are, although, again, that's really not something that anybody could claim about all novels, but I think that in that sense, the clearest connection between, like, these two projects is that this is in a lot of ways, like, a very formalist novel, or that it does in a lot of ways play with its own constructedness, with how the story is being told, with why is it as elliptic as it is, because it's, in a sense, it's a very repetitive novel that keeps on returning to the same places over and over in new constellations, which I think is something that formally comes from poetry, but, like, on the level of content, it's also a very important artifact of psychoanalysis. So that there is something that, like, I have formally inherited from my attempts at writing poetry that I've done before, but are also on a different level very profoundly connected to what this novel is really trying to be about.
And apart from being the sort of the birthplace of psychoanalysis, was there anything else about the historical context in which you have set this novel, i.e. the end of the century, the end of the 19th century in the Austro-Hungarian Empire? Was there anything that impelled you, that motivated you to want to write a novel set in that specific context?
It just, to me, it felt like such an organic decision, because I don't think like love is irrational, but we don't really know why somebody might be very important to us. It's also rarely very clear why certain topics are attractive to us. And like, to that, I have just, there have been so many different returns in both my life and my work, where I, for some reason or another, have found myself compelled to think about specifically the figure of Leopold von Sacher-Masoch, that it just, at one point, he became like the central point of departure of something that I knew wanted to be a story. And in one way or another, that became like very closely connected to my increasing interest in turn of the century as a phenomenon in Central European history that I felt was in a lot of ways pregnant with a lot of the same tensions that we're experiencing now in the contemporary historical moment, because it feels that the history of the 20th century is very, very strongly marked with painfully obvious historical conflict and trauma, in the way that the history of turn of the century, late 19th century, and in this entire period before World War I that the novel is set in, is not. But all of the things that are going to explode in decades to come are already there. They're just, in a lot of ways, not quite politicized yet. More than that, they're a part of how people are intimately experiencing their being in the world. They're latent, as, you know, psychoanalysis would teach us to say, which I thought was something that felt very important to me living in the moment that I'm living in now, to try to think through, because in a lot of ways, it felt that there was like a binding similarity to it. So
I'm very interested to hear you say that, because I did feel some of those, I had some of those same impressions, that there was some quite pertinent parallels between the context in which a novel's set and the present day. So it was very interesting to hear you make all of that explicit. Perhaps we could have another reading then, something else from the novel.
So I'll give you a little excerpt out of the 13th chapter. When Maximilian and I joined Helene and Wolfgang in Davos that summer, I practically expected that I would languish from missing Jakob, but I didn't. In fact, it did me good, the distance and the time that went in it, time that I could use to think about him instead of being with him, to write to him and read his letters to me, to let words do the great work of creating intimacy without bodies having to be present. Now that we're not together, he wrote, I've once again set about reading Sacher-Masoch. I had almost forgotten what marvelous things he wrote. I even think now that what I recalled as being important about his work is actually only of secondary importance, that it was never so much a matter of his teaching me how not to be ashamed of my own race, but rather of teaching me how not to be ashamed of myself as a human being. That the things my own father, who was never able to reconcile himself to the fact that I was never going to take over his business, that I wasn't going to defend my honor with shouting and fistcuffs, that I couldn't and wouldn't become like him, that these things that my own father viewed as weaknesses and cowardice were perhaps the things that a person ought to aspire to. That perhaps not we, but the people who saw violence and cruelty as manifestations of decisiveness were wrong. I know what you'll say. I know you'll reproach me for having overlooked critical passages in order to interpret them thus, but I want you to know that when I look at you, I see in you the traces of what your father had taught me. That you, with all your understanding, gentleness, and humor, are a reflection of something that Zahir Mazach understood, and though he perhaps didn't know how to carry it out in the most elegant way, at least he knew how to pass that knowledge on to others. I don't want you to think that you have value for me just because you happen to be his daughter. It's just gratifying for me to see how certain threads that I didn't even realize passed through me come together in you. I hope, though I know there's not much to hope for, that Switzerland isn't too boring for you. What sincere language this is, I thought, almost more than the people who use it. How much truth there was in phrases like having value for someone or meaning something to someone. How clearly the phrasing signaled that there was nothing essential about love, that everything was relational. I didn't believe him when he wrote that I didn't have value for him just because I happened to be Leopold's daughter, but it didn't bother me, even if perhaps it should have. It was also endearing for me that this person, this almost complete stranger, should admire Leopold for all the same attributes that I did. Wouldn't Leopold have been fond of him, I thought, if he had been able to know him? To think of all that they could have talked about, would Jakob have got him to talk about his father, to express his fear and insecurity, to break free of the tyrant against whom even death had been powerless? Jakob didn't know about these things, and as though I wanted to protect the image he had of Leopold, I never told him. Leopold knew how to be brave only when he was writing. Judging from the way he behaved around angry, power-obsessed people who carried some weight in the world, I seriously doubt that he ever defied his father. Leopold was intent on avoiding conflict at all costs because, as he liked to say, he couldn't have endured it. And as a result, he caused a lot of damage. And in some sense, that really was cowardice. As if my memory were trying to remind me of something, I suddenly recalled how wise and kind Leopold could seem when he invited his friends in Brook to come play chess with him and discourse on human nature. How he could tell them that he only trusted women because men, in their cruelty, were personally responsible for all the ills of history. That women, if only by dint of the fact that they'd had to suffer so much at the hands of men, were always at least a little better, and that the only thing a man could do if he wanted to think of himself as a good person was to become as like women as possible, forsake all ambition to dominate and assume the role of the victim, turn the other cheek and do the penance for the historical guilt set on him at birth. And how he would force Wanda to sit with him and nod, how he would praise her to whichever interlocutor was present. How strong my wife is, he'd say. How kind and how beautiful. I can't think what I've done to deserve her love, and yet she gives it. Isn't she perfect? Look at her. Is it even possible not to fall in love with her? Haven't you, perhaps, also fallen in love with her, even just a little? It's all right. You can tell me frankly. I won't hold it against you. It's only natural for a person to be drawn to perfection. And you know, he said, I come to the conclusion long ago that I can't keep such perfection just for myself. She deserves to be free, and what is worse, she has to be free. Go ahead, ask her if she'd like to give you a kiss if you want her to. I certainly won't stand in your way. Who am I to prevent other people from being happy? I recall one of his friends, whose name I forgot long ago, once saying to Wanda, I don't see how you can stand it. You do know that what he's doing with you verges on prostitution. Wanda shrugged. He's complicated, she said, but he's not a bad man. How can you say that he isn't bad when he literally offers you to other men? He asked. He's insecure, she said. he worries that I might leave him, so he'd rather have some active role in it than be powerless in the face of it. Even if that were true, the friend said, it doesn't justify anything. Don't worry about me, she said. It's not that important. After that, she stopped coming to visit that particular friend. I also remember how once, for my presumptive birthday, she showed me a letter he had written to her when he disappeared to Limburg that year he discovered me. Because it has recently become clear, he wrote, that your love for me has reached a point where you prefer to see me hanging from the gallows, my determination that it's no longer possible for us to live together on the terms that you set yourself will probably come as a relief to you. I leave it to you to decide whether you would prefer to remain in Brook or move elsewhere. If you choose the latter, I will, of course, remain here. If you prefer the former, I will move away. Do you know why he left? She asked me. I shook my head. I was 7 years old. I knew nothing. Because a week after giving birth to Mitya, I refused to sleep with some fellow he had found for me through a want ad he'd placed in Wiener Tagblatt. Leopold knew what it meant to be a good person, but through his weaknesses, he'd probably caused more damage than a person who openly declares himself an advocate of evil would.
Thank you, Katia. You just heard Katia Perat reading from her latest novel, The Masochist, out now on East Frost Books. Katia, thank you for your reading. I wanted to ask you now about a quote that I found from a literary critic named Goran Dekleva. And according to Goran Dekleva, Slovenia is a self-professed nation of poets. And I wanted to ask you your take on this. Are the Slovenes a nation of poets, in your opinion? And if so, in what sense are they different in their aesthetic values and their understanding and relationship with poetry in comparison to perhaps the United States, where you live now?
Well, I don't know. I think there's like an obvious historical answer to it, which I think, I mean, we very, very rarely or too rarely talk about decolonization on European soil. And I think in that particular context, like from, you know, the 1848 revolutions on, and all of the countries trying to like constitute like a form of independence inside of the empires found culture a very important part of that project. And I think that given that, you know, 19th century and the revolutions of 1848 really, historically speaking, have not happened that long ago, I think there's still that a lot of that sentiment and the fact that these are all the national projects that in one way or another were conceived as cultural projects, it's still very much alive. And I think a lot of the, you know, Slovenes as the nation of poets has a lot to do with that, or in one, any shape or form is an echo of that feeling. I think that particularly in a language spoken by 2 million people, there is some sort of a relationship to language and linguistic culture that I think like is qualitatively different than it is in, you know, English, that is the wanted or not wanted lingua franca of the world, that is something that you have to speak if you want to be heard. I think in a language that is minute in comparison to that, there's also other, I mean, not also, but predominantly other needs for why is it spoken and why is it written in. So I don't know. I don't think that everybody who is writing poetry in Slovene is like sitting at the desk with that in mind, but I think that that's definitely a sentiment that is present even when it's not being recognized or specifically referred to. Again, blatant.
So in a sense that even if people writing poetry in the Slovenian context today aren't even fully conscious of it, there is a certain sort of legacy of culture and an understanding of culture as an instrument of nation state building, as a remnant of 19th century European romanticism or something like that?
Well, romanticism is a really vast, vast word. I don't know if like it's quite useful to that particular thing, but I do think that the role that culture has in society is definitely defined, you know, by the sediments of roles that it had in prior times. And I think that, I mean, that's definitely something that would pop up when people are trying to even, you know, think about or do some sort of historicizing labor with clothing culture, but also many other minor language cultures, and definitely almost all of the cultures of Central Europe.
Yeah, I'm actually reading quite a lot of Fernando Pessoa, who is, a lot of people may know, as a Portuguese poet who was very much who spent a lot of time thinking about the relationships between power and culture, and the projects and the orchestrated efforts to construct a cohesive national identity in early 20th century Europe. So it definitely does seem to be a pan-European phenomenon. Absolutely.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
Well, perhaps we could then have another reading from your book. Yeah, I'll hand it over to you if you'd like to set this up and read for us.
Nearly a month had passed when I was informed that Maximilian would like to speak with me. Just the thought of having to talk to him was agonizing, but I also realized that the situation as it was then was unsustainable. Were we going to live out the rest of our lives in the same house, avoiding each other? Instinctively, I expected that the only thing we could discuss would be how to separate with the least possible damage, but I was wrong. We were sitting across from each other, as if composed in an official artificial tableau designed to mimic a courtroom, when Maximilian calmly said that he had made some inquiries and find out that Steinhof had a discrete separate set of pavilions set away from the main part of the hospital that could be rented, where I could go to recover. "So you want to commit me to an insane asylum," I said coldly. It was understandable that he couldn't look at me straight in the face. I couldn't bear looking at him either. We were each feeling things that excluded and negated what the other was feeling. We reminded each other of misfortune, and we had never, not even before, been able to find a language that could bridge the abyss between us. We were living proof that Wanda had been right when she bitterly claimed that there was nothing less natural in the world than marriage. It was natural that we wanted to get out of each other's way, but why couldn't we find a dignified way of doing that? And why was it so obvious to Maximilian that I was going to have to be the one to sacrifice her dignity in order to provide a break without necessitating divorce? "Help you get better," he said. "Not commit you." "In a psychiatric facility," I said, "where they douse hysterical women with cold water to shock them back into their senses," I added. "Nada," he said and fell silent. It was the silence of a teacher who had grown sick of explaining the same material to his student for the 100th time. "What?" I said. "Surely you must see how much damage you're causing with this depression." "Because young women are forbidden very early on from giving too much rein to their anger, at first I had no way of gauging what was happening to me. What was happening in my ribcage and forcing its way up was completely physical. A caustic alert that what was happening to me had to be unjust. Maximilian and I never argued. Each of us had been trained that any dignified person had to resist expressing their feelings too directly. He was too rational, while I was too convinced that if I gave any evidence of the destructive forces inside me, I would be condemned to solitude. But suddenly solitude seemed like a blessing. It was certainly closer to the truth than whatever farce was playing itself out between us in the dining room. "You are the one who shot and killed the person, not me," I said in a voice that barely pierced during the sorrow had tightened around my throat. This would be the perfect moment to lose my voice, I thought, but things never come when you ask for them. You know full well that that person shot himself, and I was just an accessory to his madness. If he sought help in time, we might all have avoided this unfortunate situation. I was repulsed by the prospect that Maximilian, if unchallenged, might end up playing the role of the only mentally balanced person trapped on a ship of fools. So, to sum up, I'm supposed to assume full responsibility for my own mental state when you're the one who went and shot a man dead, who, by the way, is responsible for that, too. Do you have any idea what you did? A man was walking around, breathing and speaking. His thoughts moved freely and came together in sentences. He laughed and told jokes, and now he'll never tell another joke again, ever, because you shot him. And my last use of the word shot, I sobbed out loud. At least have enough respect, Maximilian said, as if from the grave, not to lament your lover in my presence. That was the first time he indicated in any way whatever that he knew what had been at stake. I felt sorry for him, sorry that I hurt him, since I was still close enough to him that I could sense his own grief as though it was also mine in some way. But the sober, forced, rationalistic way he expressed it was abhorrent to me and only served to feed the hatred I was feeling towards him for being the person who had shot the man who, even though he wasn't my husband in the eyes of the law, was still enough a part of my body that when he was killed, I felt one of my own limbs had been cut off. How horrific this all turned out, I suddenly thought. But perhaps Maximilian was right. Perhaps I really was somebody who caused pain wherever she went. I'm sorry, I suddenly said. And I really was sorry for everything. So am I, Maximilian said. It had been decades since we'd been this open with each other, if we'd ever been. I could try seeing Freud again, I said. What for? Are you in such a hurry to find a new Jewish prick for yourself? I felt as though somebody had just taken an axe and hacked at my soul. It took my breath away. When it came to fighting, Maximilian's style was similar to Leopold's, I realized, in a way that he only showed understanding in order to make that what followed hurt even more. I had no weapon to defend against that. I can't talk to you, Maximilian. I really didn't mean that as a reproach. It was simply the truth. I had no verbal response to his insult. It was impossible to express what I felt, which defied words. Too bad, you're just going to have to, he said. How many times had he evaded conversations with me that I thought were necessary, even essential? Conversations that, if we had them at the time we should have, might have prevented the monstrous deaths that we now had to reckon with. No, Maximilian, I don't have to do anything, just die. I didn't mean to be dramatic. On the contrary, it meant to be slightly humorous, but my voice was so humorless that the words about death just remained suspended in the air like the low clouds of late autumn. I withdrew to my rooms and locked the door. Maximilian pounded on the door with his fist until he relented sometime towards evening. The next morning, I caught the train headed for Lemberg alone. At that point, I didn't know precisely what I was going to do, though I was half thinking I might try to realize a never-completed plan that Jakob and I had, while the other half of me felt compelled to visit the invisible roots that behind my back had formed me into a person condemned to unhappiness. Today, though, I think it was more a matter of waiting to force Maximilian into feeling remorse. Although I preferred to think I was leaving him, my resistance to him bound us tightly together. I was leaving him, though I was still caught up in us. It was precisely the way Leopold would have left. I had also inherited from Leopold a predication for third-class railway cars. I had been shut away in my room for so long that the presence of strangers did me good, even if they were eating pickled beef and transporting live roosters in cages placed on the bench beside them. I was happy to be in motion, which provided a simulacrum of change. Perhaps now I'll finally be able to think things over in peace, I said to myself. I fell asleep almost before the train had left Vienna behind. before I dropped off, I remember thinking the perspicacious Leopold has been when he said that human history only seems to be the history of intellect, when in fact it was the history of fashion.
Thank you, Katia. I wanted to ask you now, what are you working on at the moment? Do you have any projects either ongoing or planned for the future?
Well, I am currently working on my PhD, which, as those involved in a PhD program might know, takes up all of anybody's time, so I don't have any mental or real space to plan any further artistic pursuits. So for the time being, I'm mostly a scholar, although I am looking forward to having enough time to be able to think about other things as well, but I'll have to wait, unfortunately.
Well, we'll really look forward to seeing those when you've got some mental capacity for all of that. Thank you so much, Katia, for your time and your readings, and we wish you all the best.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
This has been Slovene poet and novelist Katia Perat discussing her novel, The Masochist, out in English translation by Michael Biggins, published by Estros Books.
You've been listening to The Middle Ground, a series focusing on Central and Eastern European literary cultures. This series is produced by Trafica Europe Radio. Check out our audio and other literary content at traficaeurope.org. I'm Clayton McKee, and on behalf of everyone at Trafica Europe Radio, thanks for listening.